Okay, it's 30 March. It's Wednesday. I'm Charlie Garrett, and this is the CG Midweek Prophecy Report. Blame the Jews. That and a lot of other things to go over on today's report. Okay, starting out from the Epoch Times, wrong direction to choose a Supreme Court justice based on skin color, says Ben Carson, who happens to be the same skin color as the person being evaluated right now. I will say this, she was selected because she is a demented liberal. Only that reason. Only a demented liberal will be selected. To the left, being black and being a woman are simply secondary but necessary criteria. From the Times of Israel, Prime Minister Naftali Bennett tests positive for coronavirus. Well, I'm surprised he can even walk. He's been jabbed so many times, but there you go. From Table Mag, this is a very good article. It's very long. I hope that you will understand what is going on when we get done with this. The world is focused in the wrong place right now. Biden blames the Jews for his Ukraine policy. Putin's invasion of Ukraine was precipitated by assurances from China, Germany, and the United States that each of Russia's major trading partners either backed his position or had zero interest in getting in his way. Biden's invitations to Putin to bite off more chunks of Ukraine made it clear that America was not interested in the fight with the Russian dictator in his own backyard. Surely the mighty Putin would make quick work of the Ukrainians. After all, he helped put down the Syrian rebellion to preserve Iran's stake in Syria, and thereby sealed Obama's nuclear deal with the clerical regime in Tehran. So why make a big fuss, especially since at the time Putin is intent on breaking Ukraine, he is also brokering the new Iran deal with U.S. negotiators in Vienna? The problem for Biden is that Putin is not winning his war in anything like the quick and easy fashion that the White House and other world powers apparently expected. Moreover, the prospect of a dictator murdering thousands of Ukrainians in Europe in a prolonged war may be a tougher pill to swallow for so-called Western elites than the same dictator helping to murder 500,000 Syrians. The last thing the world needs is another nuclear-armed dictatorship flush with cash and attacking its neighbors. But that's what Biden and his Iran envoy, Robert Malley, are creating in the deal they are about to close in Vienna, according to career State Department sources. Biden's position has thus become difficult, even with the captive media eager to read from a script in which the stolen president of the U.S. bravely rallies NATO to do something, while in fact doing as close to nothing as politically possible. Luckily, the White House has a playbook for situations in which the contradictions between appearance and reality threaten to overwhelm the ever-changing storylines about who is responsible for, say, $6 per gallon gas. The playbook, like the Iran deal, is a legacy of the Obama admin and a variation on an old incantation, blame the Jews. In the case of Ukraine, blaming the Jews might seem like a stretch. The Jewish state is a regional power in a region far from Ukraine. But senior Capitol Hill sources told Tablet that the Biden admin is trying to put Israel in the line of fire by pushing Jerusalem to mediate between Kiev and Moscow. The point is to position Israel to catch the blame if Putin doesn't relent, or the stubborn Ukrainians prove unwilling to surrender enough territory to end the war on terms that the Russian president finds acceptable. Sources explain that the Israelis have reluctantly relayed messages between the two states, but don't want to get further involved for two reasons. First, with Russian forces on their Syrian border, the Israelis don't want trouble with Putin. Second, they see that the White House is setting them up for failure by forcing them into taking a stand against Putin. Team Biden's PR offensive blaming Israel for the failure of two-faced U.S. policy has included Under Secretary of State Victoria Nuland's warnings to Jerusalem not to help hide dirty money belonging to Putin-allied oligarchs. I mentioned that either Sunday or last Wednesday. Nuland also said that Israel should join the international sanctions regime targeting Russian assets, a regime that notably does not include world powers like China and India, which Nuland failed to mention. The admin's misdirection campaign also relied on Biden's validators from the foreign policy establishment. Richard Haass and Aaron David Miller tweeted to the effect that if Israel wants to become an American ally, it should stand with American values, embodied by its moral stance towards Russia, which includes impoverishing ordinary Russians by crashing the ruble. The coordinated operation to embroil Israel culminated in a story last week pushed out by the White House's communications infrastructure inside Israel, whose lead publicist, Axios reporter Barak Ravid, proved his value during the Obama years. The story, which quickly went global, claimed that Prime Minister Bennett urged Ukrainian President Zelensky to accept Putin's terms of surrender. A senior Ukrainian official claimed Bennett initiated the call. According to an account sourced to an anonymous Ukrainian official and given to Ravid, the source claimed that Bennett recommended Zelensky take the offer. Was the story true? The Ukrainian government said it was false and moved to correct the record the next day. Zelensky advisor Mikhail Podolyak wrote on Twitter that Israel did not push the Ukrainians to accept the concessions Putin demanded to end the invasion. Zelensky advisor tweeted that Bennett, just as other conditional intermediary countries, does not offer Ukraine to agree to any demands of the Russian Federation. Instead, he wrote, Israel urges Russia to assess the events more adequately. He also pointed out that the source could not have been on the call, which was private and was probably not in Ukraine. But whether the surrender story is true or not, shouldn't the Israelis be openly and proudly pro-Zelensky? Ukraine's president has won the affection of decent and smart people the world over, who have festooned their Facebook pages and Twitter feeds with the blue and yellow Ukrainian flag. And he's Jewish. Why doesn't Israel join in? The reality is that Israel has frequently stood up for Ukraine against Russia and with little to show for it. But the issue in this case is simple. The Russian military is on Israel's border, kind of like it was on Ukraine's border before it invaded. The difference is that the Russian-Ukrainian border is a geopolitical fact. Russia is only on Israel's border due to a geostrategic power play that Moscow implemented with the acquiescence of the U.S. political faction now trying to drive Israel toward conflict with Putin. Listen to these next couple of sentences. The purpose of the Biden team's anti-Israel smear campaign is not just to make the Israelis look like they sympathize with a tyrant while offering to hide the blood money of their Russian co-religionists. That part is just ugly propaganda. The strategic purpose of the admin's campaign is to force Jerusalem into an error that will give Putin reason to move against Israel. Sounds like Ezekiel 38 to me, and thereby further limit its ability to strike Iran or its allies. As with Obama, Biden's moves against Israel are keyed to the Iran deal. Despite some occasional public vows of affection for Israel, Obama's performative progressives, who staff nearly every important position in the Biden admin, do not see it as an ally. Insofar as Israel jeopardizes the Iran deal, it is a U.S. adversary. Russia, on the other hand, is an important partner in getting the deal across the finish line. Putin supplied the deterrence that protected the only foreign policy goal that really mattered to Obama. With Putin in Syria, Israel could only go so far. The hypocrisy, gaslighting, and attempt to blame Israel for Russian depredations started more than a decade ago with the onset of the Syrian war. Putin stood behind Moscow's Cold War era ally and its only remaining regional partner, the regime Bashar Assad inherited from his father, Hafez. The Russians armed the Syrian government and represented it in international forums like the United Nations, whereby they regularly blocked action against Assad. When Obama's UN ambassadors, Susan Rice and Samantha Power, complained about the Russians' immoral support for Assad, their shrill protests appeared designed to underscore American impotence. In fact, it disguised the disturbing reality that Obama was on the Russians' side. That's because by defending Assad, Moscow was also defending the nuclear deal with Assad's other patron, Iran. Instead of owning up to a policy that put the UN on the side of tyrants in Moscow, Damascus, and Tehran, the Obama team claimed that the fault lay with its regional allies, especially Israel, which was said to be pleading to keep the Russian-backed strongman in power. The idea then, as now, was to make the Israelis take the blame for what was, in fact, the American position, supporting despotic and anti-American regimes. Israel's then ambassador to U.S., Michael Oren, repeatedly tried to correct the record. "I must once again state," Oren wrote in 2011, "that Israel wants the Assad regime to be replaced by a genuine Syrian democracy that eschews terror, turns its back on Iran, and seeks peace with its Israeli neighbor." But it didn't matter how many times Jerusalem explained its actual position. Israel's alliance with the United States prevented it from blaming the Americans, which meant that the Americans were free to act in bad faith and blame Israel. Even with Moscow supporting Assad's war on their border, the Israelis stood publicly with Ukraine. Shortly after Putin's 2014 annexation of Crimea, Israel voted at the United Nations in defense of Ukraine's territorial integrity. Soon, Russian forces would move toward Israel's borders with the 2015 escalation in Syria, a move celebrated at the time by U.S. officials, but in no way welcomed by the Israelis. In public, Obama's aides claimed that Russia would help rid the world of ISIS and other terror groups. But that's not why Putin dispatched his forces at the request of Iranian terror commander Soleimani. The Russians were there to support Iran. And that's what Obama wanted too. What was the point, after all, of legalizing Iran's industrial-scale nuclear program if the Iranian regime was going to lose its war in Syria? Iran had to win, which meant Putin had to help. The government of then-Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu understood that for the first time in half a century, Jerusalem would not have Washington's support if it wound up in a shooting war with Moscow. Accordingly, the Israelis worked out a modus vivendi with Putin, a deconfliction mechanism by which Israel was permitted in certain circumstances to attack Syrian and Iranian forces, including Hezbollah. But should the Israelis get it into their heads to conduct airstrikes against Iranian nuclear facilities, they'd have hell to pay on their border. Putin supplied the deterrence that protected the only foreign policy goal that really mattered to Obama. With Putin in Syria, Israel could only go so far. Yet, even then, in December 2016, Israel again took Kiev's side at the United Nations in a vote on the human rights situation in Crimea. How did Vice President Biden show his appreciation for Israel's principled stand against Putin's war in Europe? One week later, he strong-armed the Ukrainian president to vote for Security Council Resolution 2334, finding that Israel was in occupation of Palestinian land, which according to the resolution included historical Jewish holy sites. The Ukrainians asked to abstain, but Biden said no. Kiev then asked for a delay. There was a large and influential Jewish community in Ukraine with family ties to Israel. And after all, what would the optics be of turning against Jerusalem just days after the Israelis had stood with Ukraine? That was not good enough for Biden. So the Ukrainians joined the other powers that the Obama team had corralled into voting against Israel. The Biden admin's moves against Israel over Ukraine are part of a ghoulish puppet show. Yes, the admin will sanction the Russian economy until it bleeds, but at the same time, there is a nuclear deal with Iran giving Russia a cash-rich client eager to buy Russian arms. And why not? From the perspective of the Obama-Biden faction, Russia is hardly the main problem. That distinction is reserved for Israel. Everything is centered on what is going on with the nation of Israel. Everything. I don't care if you're in China. I don't care if you're in Venezuela. I don't care if you're sitting in Washington, D.C. Israel is the key to all of this. And the nation that does not deal properly with Iran is the nation that will end up causing the Third World War. The tribulation period will come into full focus when Iran is not properly dealt with. And the only person that was willing to properly deal with them was the previous president, who had his presidency stole from under him so that they could continue doing what they're doing right now, getting the world prepared for their big commie, one world global thing that they're doing. Okay, that is what's going on. They're thinking that the Russians are going to pretty much rule the world, along with China, of course. And that America, the people that are there in power right now, will be the ruling elite. I'm telling you, this is all of what is going on here. And this article is spot on in what they say. From Alex Berenson, the COVID vaccine era is ending already. Vaccine passports are dead. Vaccine mandates are deader. Actual vaccinations are deadest of all. All over Europe, countries are dropping COVID vaccination passports only months after introducing them. Since Friday, Italy and Greece have become the latest nations to say they will dump passport requirements as of May 1st. Both countries made the usual noises about no longer needing rules because COVID is so under control. We are, of course, keeping a very close watch on the epidemic curve, Italy's prime minister said. Yes, watching the number of new infections almost double in the last 2 weeks. Viewed over the longer term, the picture is even worse. When Italy introduced its vaccine passport last September, it had roughly 4,000 infections a day. When it tightened restrictions in December, it had under 15,000. Now it has 70,000 a day. I cannot say this enough times. COVID vaccine restrictions are ending, not because the mRNA vaccines have succeeded, but because they have failed. The depth of that failure is so complete that to explain it sounds almost conspiratorial. The mRNA vaccines do not just not work against Omicron, they have negative efficacy, which is why the most highly vaccinated countries in the world now have levels of infection far higher than they had last year or in 2020, and far higher than countries that did not use the mRNA vaccines. Here's Austria, which in January became the first country in Europe to announce not just a vaccine passport, but a COVID vaccine mandate. Austria now has more coronavirus infections than the United States, with a population 1/35th as large. No wonder Austria dumped its mandate 2 weeks ago, which they're now starting to rework again, before it ever really took effect. And no wonder the German parliament walked away last week from plans to pass its own mandate. As a result, Omicron is rocketing around Europe and parts of East Asia at levels that were previously unthinkable. Meanwhile, countries that did not use mRNA jab, or to a lesser extent, the DNA shot from AstraZeneca, have far, far smaller caseloads. In the very short run, a second booster may reduce infections marginally. But even the most committed vaccine fanatics are pressing a fourth shot only half-heartedly, since clinical trial data supporting its use basically do not exist. And the pattern is now clear. Once the supranational antibodies wane, the protection does too. While governments will not openly admit the COVID jabs have failed, their citizens understand the reality. Fewer than 80,000 Americans a day are now getting boosters out of more than 100 million people who are eligible. By definition, the booster audience should not be vaccine hesitant, since it consists of people who already took the COVID jabs. Thus, the only real question left is not whether countries will be able to convince their citizens to take more mRNA jabs, but what happens next to the people who have already taken them. That is, whether they have any kind of durable immunity after they are infected against reinfection, either with Omicron or with other variants. It is too soon to know, but the fact that infections are again rising in Israel less than 2 months after it saw a massive Omicron surge is worrisome. Meanwhile, both COVID deaths and all-cause mortality remain stubbornly high. The mRNA vaccine era began barely a year ago with incredible optimism. Unfortunately, the reality has been very different. The question now becomes how much longer the governments, academics, companies, and journalists who pressed these shots on more than 1 billion people can keep denying the truth. And to support this, from the Epoch Times, New Zealand scraps COVID-19 restrictions, including vaccine passports, mandates, and QR codes. New Zealand has announced the end of QR codes, mask rules, COVID-19 vaccine passports, and mandates in most industries. From April 4th, vaccine passport rules will be removed and vaccination mandates will be lifted in all industries except health and disability, aged care, corrections, and border fences. What I'd like you to do now that I've read you just that short little paragraph is go and type in coronavirus cases in New Zealand, and you'll get a chart right from Google, and you'll see that it was very, very straight all the way across, and then in February, it started to go up just like this, and right now, it is at a high peak, and they're taking all of these restrictions down? Why would they do that when they have all of these cases? It's because they know exactly what Alex Berenson just said. These don't work. They are ineffective, and they are actually harmful. And so they've just opened up. They've gotten rid of all of their restrictions after the cases are going skyrocketing. From the Courier Journal, Louisville Health Department leader who oversaw COVID-19 vaccine distribution has died. Dr. Sarah Beth Hartledge, who helped lead Louisville's fight against COVID-19 in her role as associate medical director of the health department, has died. Mayor Greg Fisher's office announced her death, but did not say how she died. That was about 7 or 8 days ago. They still have not released anything on her death. Guaranteed that she died a vaccine death. I just can see it. Why else wouldn't they report this? This is Miss Vaccine herself, keeled over, and I bet you $1 million. I don't have $1 million, so don't take me up on it, but I'll bet you $1 million that she died from vaccine death. From the Western Journal, military doctor testifies in court. High-level command ordered her silence over frightening vaccine data. Dr. Teresa Long testified COVID shots were resulting in members of the military developing demyelination of the central nervous system. She made that determination while working with Dr. Pete Chambers, a Green Beret surgeon. They came to their conclusion as they reviewed the Defense Medical Epidemiology Database, the military equivalent of the VAERS operated by the CDC and the US FDA. When asked during her testimony about data in the DMED, Long, a lieutenant colonel, replied, "I have been ordered not to answer that question." Ordered by who? Queried Judge Stephen Mary Day of the U.S. District Court of Florida. Long said she was told by high-level command not to bring up military data in her testimony. Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel, representing the embattled Navy commander, then asked if the data were important and relevant. "Yes," Long said. "Why?" asked Staver. Long was nearly in tears. She looked at the judge and said, "I have so many soldiers being destroyed by this vaccine. Not a single member of my senior command has discussed my concerns with me. I have nothing to gain and everything to lose by talking about it. I'm okay with that because I am watching people get absolutely destroyed." She said she is continually contacted by individuals injured by the shots. Predominantly pilots, and pilots have to meet one of the highest fitness standards. She said pressures to get the shots have resulted in at least 2 suicides she is aware of. Soldiers are despairing and morale is terrible. Chambers, a 29-year veteran member of the Texas National Guard and a Purple Heart recipient, was ordered to see that the soldiers received the shots and learned that religious exemptions would be denied. "Soldiers will try. Soldiers will fail," is what Chambers was told. In testimony, Chambers said 75 to 80% of military members got COVID despite having 2 shots. Among the unvaccinated, the infection rate was 15%. Chambers has had to shelve his 2023 retirement plans because after being vaccinated, he developed a demyelination of his central nervous system. Dr. Stuart Tankerlessy, a flight surgeon who recently retired as a colonel, testified he had never seen anything like the COVID situation. The lack of dialogue and the suppression of scientific dialogue. The shots were not safe and they were not effective. According to Tankersley, the COVID shots are causing injuries due to a required lipid nanoparticle as a delivery system to keep RNA in the shots from quickly degrading. The LNP-RNA combination sidesteps the body's immune system and causes inflammation. That can result in compromising the body's natural immunity. The doctor's testimonies came earlier this month before Judge Merriday denied a DOD request for a stay of preliminary injunction against relieving the unnamed Navy officer of command, something I talked about a couple weeks ago, maybe last week. In testimony, the officer refuted claims by his superior. A Navy Commodore that commander's refusal of the COVID shot meant his ship was incapacitated and would have to stay in its Norfolk, Virginia port. The Commodore made contradictory sworn statements regarding the commander. Initially, the Commodore swore to having lost confidence in the commander for not taking the shot. Later, the Commodore swore that not taking the COVID shot was not the reason for losing confidence, but it was due to the commander going out of area, taking leave to secure defense of his religious freedom. The leave had been granted by the Commodore. Another contradictory statement by the Commodore was saying his lost confidence meant the commander's ship could not leave the port. However, at the time of that statement, the commander already had his ship at sea, conducting drills, training, and tests. Like corporate America, along with other government agencies, the DOD barrels ahead, uncompromising on COVID shots. By now, however, millions of people are no longer blind believers in the experimental vaccine treatment. While data suggests the shots temper the degree of COVID symptoms, the foolish one-size-fits-all decrees of establishment organizations have compromised the health of some and the overall credibility of and confidence in public officials. Those people in the U.S. military, these commanders that were doing these things to their subordinates, every one of them, if Trump gets back into office, should take them and have them court-martialed and sent to the same prison where they're holding those January 6 people right now. Let them suffer over what they're doing to the U.S. military. From AgWeb, planes drought to curb U.S. wheat harvest, adding to global supply worries. A worsening drought in the southern U.S. plains is threatening the region's winter wheat crop, just as the Russian invasion of Ukraine dents global supplies. Some farmers in southwestern Kansas, the top U.S. wheat-producing state, have not received much measurable rain or snow since October. Winter wheat is planted in autumn, lays dormant in winter, and begins sending up green shoots in spring. Proper soil moisture is critical at this stage for the crop to thrive. More than half of Kansas was classified as under severe drought or worse as of March 8, according to the National Drought Mitigation Center. Severe drought is also covering three-quarters of Oklahoma and more than two-thirds of Texas, both of which are also large wheat producers. Water woes come on top of a freak December windstorm that swept away some topsoil in parts of the United States wheat belt, damaging some cropland. U.S. hard red winter wheat represents nearly half of the country's overall wheat production and is milled mainly for bread flour. A reduced crop could further stoke food inflation that the UN FAO said was the highest ever in February. The FAO's food price index averaged 140.7 points last month, a 20.7% increase from a year earlier and surpassing the 2011 record. U.S. wheat futures soared to the highest levels in 14 years as the Russia-Ukraine conflict pushed two of the world's largest wheat exporters out of the market. That has importing countries scrambling for replacement sources. Meanwhile, the winter wheat crop in China, the world's largest producer of the grain, is expected to be among the worst ever after heavy rainfall delayed planting. U.S. hard red winter wheat is harvested in June and July. Normally, farmers would sell about half their crop before the harvest, but some Kansas farmers are proceeding cautiously, unable to fully capitalize on soaring future prices due to concerns they might not be able to fulfill such contracts. "There's just no way I can make any crop sales until I know I have a crop to sell," said Gary Miller-Shashki, a farmer near Garden City in southwest Kansas. This is the second straight U.S. wheat crop stalked by drought. The 2021 harvest of spring wheat, which typically is planted between March and May, also was crimped by dry conditions. As of March 6, just 24% of Kansas wheat crop was in good condition or better, while 39% was rated poor to very poor, according to the U.S. DOA. That is the lowest rating for this point of the season in 4 years, the agency's data shows. In Grigston, Kansas, farmer Ron Suppes worries his wheat lacks enough moisture to produce even an average grain crop. Since receiving just over an inch of rain in late October, his fields have received scant additional rain. "A light snow last week contained very little moisture," he said. "Any moisture is welcome, but this was certainly not a drought buster. Far from it," he said. The coming weeks will be critical for the Southern Plains wheat crop. Many farmers apply fertilizer to maximize crop potential, but moisture is needed to carry nutrients to plant roots. Wheat plants damaged by the December windstorm that brought Dust Bowl conditions to Kansas face additional drought problems because plants have been weakened either by sandblast effect of blowing dust and dirt or by soil nutrient loss for the 100-mile-per-hour winds. Bad stuff. Epic Times. Ohio's poorest county continues to vote Democrat, remaining blue in a sea of world changes. In the heart of southeast Ohio's Appalachian region is Athens County, the state's poorest area, with a 31% poverty rate. All I can say is that once the hog starts feeding the piglets, they will never get off of the hog. They'll just keep sucking and sucking from the U.S. government. Washington Examiner, new report, 255,000 excess votes for Biden in six key 2020 states. A new deep dive into discrepancies in the ballot counts of six key battleground states in the 2020 election has turned up more than 250,000 excess votes for Biden, and maybe far more. The key point in the upcoming peer-reviewed study for the journal Public Choice by economist and noted gun expert John Lott Jr. is that the excess voting may challenge or explain Biden's margin of victory over President Trump in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. In his report on the Public Choice website, but still awaiting final approval, Lott said that there were 255,000 excess votes and possibly as many as 368,000 for Biden in the key states. And in a review of his statistical study, he said that Biden only carried these states by a total of 313,253 votes. Excluding Michigan, the gap was 159,065. Lott, who runs the Crime Prevention Research Center, said that his report was not meant to overturn the 2020 election, but to reinforce the need for changes to voter ID, absentee voting, and provisional ballots. "The point of this work isn't to contest the 2020 election, but to point out that we have a real problem that needs to be dealt with. Americans must have confidence in future elections." In the study, Lott reviewed voter registration rolls, actual in-person vote counts, absentee voting, and provisional ballots in counties where fraud has been alleged or suggested. He compared those counts to neighboring counties, arguing that the percentages should be similar. What he found were major differences, raising questions of fraud. He found unexplained votes, vast differences in absentee voting, and other problems such as bloated voter lists and felons illegally voting. In Fulton County, Georgia, 2,423 voters were not listed on the state's records as registered, and 2,560 felons voted even though they had not completed their sentences. He concluded, "The voter turnout rate data provides stronger evidence of significant excess Biden votes. The estimates imply that the counties wherein vote fraud was alleged returned between 142,000 and 368,000 excess Biden votes. While the findings reported here are dramatic, They may be underestimates because the voter turnout estimates do not account for ballots cast for the opposing candidate that are lost, destroyed, or replaced with ballots filled out for the other candidate. While it would involve a lot more work, it would be possible to apply the precinct level test to compare turnout rates in adjacent precincts across all the counties where fraud was alleged. The findings are likely to continue fueling questions raised by Trump supporters and the former president himself that an election they saw going their way on election night turned against them after midnight. Such is the world in which we live. And so from Sarasota, Florida to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, I am Charlie Garrett, and that is your midweek CG report.